Five, so we can call the meeting.
We were in order already.
We'll wait for a bit until we have a quorum to pass to move the minutes. Members, the March 2014 report from the Office of the Legislative Auditor, as usually is appropriate, a relevant committee hears the report. And so we have Jim Nobles, the Legislative Auditor, here. Are you going to begin, Mr. Nobles?
Yes, Madam Chair.
Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members of the committee. My name is Jim Nobles. I'm the Legislative Auditor, and with me at the table is Cecile Ferkel, who is the Deputy Legislative Auditor for the Financial Audit Division. And thank you, Madam Chair, for inviting us to be here. We feel a real kinship and bond with, no pun intended, with this committee because, as you know, our mission is to extend and strengthen legislative oversight and accountability throughout state government. And I know from observing you over the years that you put a great deal of effort into the decisions that you make about how bond money is going to be spent. And as we're going to talk, there are a lot of strings attached to that money, a lot of criteria that have to be fulfilled in terms of the utilization of that money. And so our job, some years after you make those decisions, is to go out and determine in the details whether or not the money was spent according to all the legal standards that apply. And, Madam Chair, just one other point. I know that you do get into detail, and you look at the big picture as well, but there are a lot of details that occur after the projects are underway and being built. And so one of the things you're going to hear from us is that we go down into those details in sort of the pieces and parts of the project, because sometimes, even though the project itself is certainly eligible for the use of bond money under the constitutional requirements, the legal requirements, there may be some individual pieces and parts of the project that are not. And that's where it gets more complicated and sometimes even unclear as to whether or not those parts of the project can use bond money. And I think it's important not only for the folks spending that money to know that, but I think it's useful for the members of this committee to realize where some of those issues arise. And so as people come to you and propose a project, it might be useful for you to know that there are parts of that project that are going to have to find other money, not bond money, to fulfill the terms of the project. But we'll get into that. So first, Madam Chair, just to understand the scope of what this audit was all about, we were looking at the appropriations laws for 2008 and 2010. Together, those two laws appropriated $1.6 billion. And at the time of our field work, there had been $1.3 billion expended. That is, as of February 28, 2013. So one of the first things...
Of that 1.6?
That's correct.
Okay.
So the first thing that you see is that we come in quite a bit later because these are large projects, and the money has to be spent, obviously, before we do our audit work. So there is some time lag after you make those decisions and we go do the audit work. So you also see that there was a lot of money involved. Now, we cannot go out and test everything, but as is normal in an audit, we do a test of a certain sample. And so what you see in that next bullet point is that of that $1.6 billion, we created a test pool of $558 million in expenditures that represented 28 projects administered by 12 entities. And if you want to get more details about the entities that were a part of our testing pool, look on page 5, and there's a table that will give you all of those details. So, Madam Chair and members, when we go out and do this kind of audit work, we have an objective. And in this case, our objective was to determine whether or not the entities that received general obligation bond money from the 2008-2010 appropriations laws used the money in compliance with all of the various legal requirements and whether or not they had adequate internal controls to ensure compliance. We're really going to be focusing today on compliance issues, but just so you know, we also are testing whether or not they have adequate internal controls. Our overall conclusion in this audit was that the entities that were a part of our testing generally did comply with the requirements of the law and did have adequate internal controls. However, we did find some non-compliance issues and some control weaknesses. And again, we're going to focus on some of the non-compliance issues that we found. So how do we determine whether or not entities have complied? Well, there's a large array of legal requirements, criteria that they have to comply with. And so we familiarize ourselves with those. We start with the Constitution. And as you know, the Constitution sets forth a number of criteria and requirements for the use of bond money. We actually look at that, but we really give deference and respect to the decisions that you've made, because I know that's a very big thing that you consider, whether this project complies with the various requirements of Article 11, Section 5 for GO bond. So once we take a look at that, look at some of the deliberations that you've gone through, we get into the appropriations laws, the specific language that you enacted that tell us what did you intend in the law for this project to be. And then we get into the various statutory requirements that are more generic, more general to all of these projects. We also look at MMB policies. And those policies are based in large part on bond council opinions. We also, from time to time, look at generally accepted accounting principles that may tell us from that point of view whether or not what we're looking at is a capital asset or not. So once we've familiarized ourselves with all of those, we go out into the field, we look at documents, we do a lot of interviewing, and we make judgments, getting the facts, comparing those to the various criteria. And so now let us get into some of the issues that we found. There are a lot of details in this report, and we're not going to go through all of them. So I want to just talk about some of the key non-compliance findings. And again, I think this will be helpful to members as you're considering projects that people bring to you and want bond money for. You may hear in some of the things that we're going to go through some things that resonate with you about some of the projects that you're currently considering. For example, you may realize that, gosh, there's going to have to be some moving and relocation as a part of that project. And what we determined and what we learned, particularly from MMB's guidance and bond council opinions, you cannot use GO bond money for moving and relocation costs. This actually came as something of a surprise to me. I don't think it's intuitive that if you have a big project and you have to move a lot of things out of a building, let's say you're going to rehab that building and it is a capital project, you might think, well, moving everything out, storing it somewhere, relocating, should be part of that project and therefore bondable. Well, it's not. And so as people bring projects to you and you have some sense that there's going to be some significant cost related to relocation, moving, you might ask them, where is that money going to come from? Because MMB has determined that you cannot use GO bond money. So I'm going to ask Cecile Furkel to speak in a little more detail about that issue and some of the others that you see listed as non-compliance issues. So, Madam Chair, if I could turn to Ms. Furkel.
Welcome to the committee.
Thank you.
Please identify yourself for the record.
I'm Cecile Furkel. I'm the Deputy Legislative Auditor.
Thank you.
Expanding on what Jim said about the moving and relocation, just to give you a real-life example of how some of the bond money was used for that and how it cannot be, you know, it's not always real intuitive that it would not be allowed. About we cited about $350,000 of bond money that was used for moving and relocation. About $300,000 of that was for St. Paul College to move its auto body machine shop and carpentry shop so that some renovations could be done with bond money. And you can see that's not just packing up an office and putting some files into a box. These are big, substantive moves. In order to keep those programs running, they had to reestablish those programs in some temporary space. But we still consider that to be part of the unallowable relocation and moving costs related to the project. Moving on to capital costs, when we first looked at this, there's a lot of definitions that you need to get in your head as you're looking at what's allowable and what's not allowable. And one of the things that we determined was that the costs need to be either capital costs or operating costs. When you look at a financial statement, you've got operating costs, and then you've got capital costs that are depreciated or amortized, and that's the kind of distinction that we were making here. We found about $20,000 in the sample that we tested that were used for things that were clearly to us operating costs, things like buying supplies and computer software licenses and maintenance agreements for a photocopier, that kind of thing. Those really are more operating costs and not the kinds of things that you would use bond money for. And another thing that we found was the asset preservation money that's used by higher ed. There are some restrictions on how that money can be used. It's supposed to preserve or replace existing facilities, but we found that some of that money was used for things like furniture, audiovisual equipment, computer equipment. We cited about $250,000 of higher ed asset preservation money that we believe did not comply with the purpose of the statute of the appropriation. Another thing that we saw was that at the Board of Water and Soil Resources, they had been given an appropriation that allowed them to use 10%, $2.5 million of their bond appropriation to implement the program, implement the easement program. And when we looked at the costs, we found that they had granted some money out for implementation costs. They were $2,000 grants for each easement purchase. It totaled up to be hundreds of thousands of dollars. And they coded that grant activity in the accounting system not to the implementation grant but to the easement grant. And we thought that this was a miscoding because the grants clearly seemed to be specifically for implementation. We looked back at board approvals and saw that the board had approved these grants to be used from the implementation money, and the grant agreements themselves said that they were implementation grants. So when we added that to the cost that Bowser had used for implementation costs, it exceeded that $2.5 million limit, and that's the amount that we are questioning then in the report.
Madam Chair, if I could just point out, we've given you some page numbers because there are a lot of details behind what we are talking about, and this one in particular on page 23, if you want to either now or later look at those details. I would just add, too, this is one of those findings where there is a difference of opinion between Bowser and the Office of the Legislative Auditor. We bring it forth to you with our conclusion, but in the response that you'll see in the back of the report, the executive director of Bowser disagrees with us and believes that our interpretation of the $2,000 per grant for implementation should not be added to the 10% cap that was on implementation. And they're here if we have time and you want to talk to them about that.
And we are going to first have MMB come up after you finish, and then I think we'll certainly invite any agencies. I know many of them are here, but you do, members, have all of the letters in the back of the report, which are quite to the point also. So, continue. Representative Carson.
Chair, when would you like to take questions as he goes or at the end?
Do you have a preference?
I really don't, Madam Chair.
Representative Carlson.
Yeah, I was looking at, I was reading after you were surprised. I was a bit surprised as well about the moving expenses. But there's language at the very bottom of page, page 9, where it says the department issued a memo for present and past appropriations, and I'm not sure exactly what that means when you say past appropriations. Did they have to somehow adjust their budget, or was that just to clarify even what they did in the past was not correct and to do it?
Madam Chair,
what did that mean?
Representative Carlson, I certainly would leave it to the department to speak to you on that point, but I think they were trying to capture the fact that there are many projects that where the appropriation has occurred two or three years but earlier, but the project is still in process. And so I think they may have wanted to capture that there could be some expenditures in process from previous appropriations that they wanted to limit and not allow these kinds of expenditures with the use of bond money. I think the important point here, and we emphasize this a lot, and that is we really think there needs to be more clear guidance from MMB on some of these points. Now, in this particular case, they did put out this memo, and they drew a pretty bright line, and we certainly questioned them about that, whether or not the line really was that bright or whether there could be some exceptions. And again, you can certainly speak to them about that. But clearly, there were organizations, and I think understandably, that were out there with bond money thinking that they could use bond money for substantial relocation and moving costs. And so, again, I think Representative Carlson, the department was simply trying to alert everybody, if you've got something ongoing, realize that you cannot use your bond money for moving and relocation.
Yeah, Madam Chair, that if it was ongoing, I understand. I was assuming if a project was done and what that memo might mean in that regard. But thank you.
Continue.
Thank you. There also were a variety of other types of ineligible costs, and these are kind of just specific instances. I want to run through them quickly because I think they're pretty interesting. Amateur Sports Commission used about $16,000 to pay for travel for an employee to attend a course about project management so that the employee would have sufficient skills to oversee the project that they receive bond money for. Training costs generally are not considered to be bondable expenses, and travel costs for that because the employee may take all that knowledge with them, and also because it's generally accepted that if you're going to get money to administer a project, you already have the skills to do that administration. You don't need to use the project money in order to get that project accomplished. Also, we saw the Minsku used some money, bond money. They used their 1% of the arts to build a fountain on a campus. And in the end, when the fountain was delivered, they realized that it was only the structure within the fountain and that the cost that they had allocated to the art project didn't include the actual construction of the cement fountain that would spray the water up and make the art structure a real part of that. So they ended up spending more than the 1% for the arts to get that project done. So there are a couple of other things in there. One where they
the hurdle was yours to this section.
Oh, yeah, kind of.
Sure, okay. Representative Hurdle.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and I didn't realize it was Purple Day. But
I tend to do.
Just a question. Is there any time when administrative cost is a bondable expense?
Mr. Nobles, or?
Well, Madam Chair, Representative Erdahl, I would say yes, and I would point back to the one we just discussed relative to Bowser and the implementation of the easements. You, as a legislature, said, as Ms. Ferkel indicated, you said they could use 10% for implementation. I think you raise an interesting point, though, that certainly you and I and others have debated for a very long time, and that is kind of definitions, overhead, administration, management, implementation. Are those all the same thing? Are they distinct? And we had, frankly, a little bit of a debate on whether or not there's a difference between administration and implementation, but I think the simple answer to your question is if it's very closely related to the project itself, and you can tie those costs very specifically to that capital project, my understanding would be that you could use some money for administration or implementation.
Thank you.
Ms. Ferkel?
We're going to the next slide.
Were you finished with the other ineligible costs?
I was, thank you.
If I could just preface, Ms. Ferkel is going to talk about some things. We worked very closely with MMB, and we really think MMB has a very central and important role here. These are complicated criteria, and MMB is really the gatekeeper, the source of guidance for individual agencies. And you're going to hear from them. But I would just start by saying we found it sometimes a bit challenging as we were trying to do our work and determine whether or not expenditures were eligible. We found it challenging to sometimes even find and interpret the criteria that are out there. And so I think one of the things we have certainly suggested to MMB is to look over all the various bond council opinions, organize them and codify them in a way that I think would be more clear to agencies, and particularly on their website, which is kind of the central focus where people would go to find that kind of guidance, and try to make it more clear, more understandable. Sometimes the bond opinions are just hard to not only interpret but find, and so I think a certain amount of work on MMB's part would really be helpful. And in particular, we have some areas that we found where there was just a good deal of ambiguity and uncertainty about what is the standard. And again, I think this would be helpful for the members of this committee to know, because you will have people come forth with projects. And on this first bullet, then I'll turn to Ms. Ferkel to talk about, we live in a world where it seems like everything is going to involve computers, some kind of complex, sophisticated IT system. From the security systems at prisons to testing labs. And so the question here is, what kinds of computers, what kinds of IT systems can you use bond money to purchase? Where is the line between a capital asset and something that doesn't qualify for what is a capital asset, which is the underlying criterion for whether something is bondable or not? So I'll turn to Ms. Ferkel again, if I could.
Ms. Ferkel.
Madam Chair. So Jim did mention then that part of our decisions when looking at the computers was, is it a capital cost or is it an operating cost? And if it is a capital cost, is it a bondable capital cost or not? So a capital cost is generally defined by how much does it cost. Is it a significant purchase or is it a less significant purchase? And how long is its useful life? And when we look at computers, as Jim mentioned, it really depends on what you're talking about. Are you talking about a laptop here? This laptop, it was probably under $1,000, and its useful life is probably under 5 years, maybe under 3 years. Is that a capital item or not? And then you've got the question, well, okay, even if we say it is a capital item for because of some definition, is it a bondable capital item? Is it something that we want to use 20-year bond money to buy when we know that within 3 years or 5 years we're going to need to repurchase something to replace that? And then you get to software costs. I think we all know how often we have to update our personal computers with new versions of Windows or new versions of Microsoft products. A software cost might have an even shorter life than the computer may have. So those were a lot of things that we assessed as we looked at how state agencies or entities that receive bond money used money to buy computer type things. And as we looked at the guidance out there, one of the things that we saw was that computer purchases can be part of a bondable project if they're integral to the building's computer operations. So you look around this room and we've got equipment on the walls, we've got cameras, we've got screens, we've got computers here. Some of it is all wired into the walls, and that would seem to be integral to the building's technology system. But does this laptop that we brought in here and plugged into the outlets, is that a thing that's integral to the building's operations? So again, that's what we were looking at. But where we, as you start drilling down into specific purchases and specific projects, even that, which seems fairly clear, even that gets more complicated. Some of the bond money was for rehabbing or creating a computer lab at a college. Well, now you've got a room that obviously needs a lot of wiring, more than a typical office might need. It needs to be able to handle, I don't know, 50 or 100 computers all working at the same time. So it needs a lot of wires and a lot of outlets and a lot of technology. It probably needs special desks and maybe even special chairs for the students. But does it need the computers that are going to be put on top of that table and plugged in, you know, virtually movable types of things that it's just plugging it into an outlet? Is that an integral part of what the money was provided for, the bond money. And the colleges did use bond money to buy the computers. And where it kind of crosses the questioning is the appropriation said that the money was also to furnish and equip. And when we get into furnish and equip, does that, how far does that go? It certainly to me means that you can buy those tables and chairs that the students are going to need to sit in. Does equip mean that, you know, all the wiring, does it, or does it mean that, yes, you can use that money to buy 50 laptops that are going to sit on those desks? And I think this is an area where Minsky and perhaps even MMB disagreed with us. And we, frankly, were not that sure. We didn't know. The guidance wasn't clear. And as any project, it's not just bricks and, you know, cement and floors anymore. Any project has a degree of technology in it. It might be a computer that runs the elevators that go up and down in the building, or it could be one of the examples we had was the security system at the prisons to keep track of inmates and the monitoring of the inmates. Part of it was certainly integral to the building, but part of it also was bracelets that the inmates would wear so they could track where they were. Those things that likely are just even a supply-type expense, those were bought with bond money, too. So we weren't sure of those kinds of decisions, and we have a finding in the report that MMB needs to clarify that those requirements for computers.
And this is probably all massively true of the capital restoration project, which is being done with GEO funds.
Well, and Madam Chair, I think this, and again, just to emphasize this, I think we've already made this point. I think we're just in such an era where virtually everything is going to involve a computer of some type or kind, and every project that comes before you probably potentially has some kind of an IT information technology or computer, however it's labeled, element. And again, I think there just need to be some really detailed discussions about what does that include. And I think it's a discussion for you, particularly with MMB, to know when these projects are before you, whether or not the agency needs to have other money to fully furnish and equip, because some of what furnish and equip equipment they need is not going to be bondable. Madam Chair, I know we are running real close to the time you need to hear from MMB, so let me just very quickly mention the other points in our discussion, and I'll leave it for you to delve into those details on the pages that are indicated. One of the important things about these projects is that sometimes there does need to be other money brought to make the financing whole. And I know over the years, and I do go back all the way to Senator Gene Merriam, and this was a point that he felt very strongly about, and that is, don't come and get part of the money from us and not have the rest of the financing lined up, because, you know, we don't want a half-bit built building. So you do have some requirements that there's supposed to be a determination that the other money, the match money, is going to be there. And again, you've put that responsibility on MMB to make that determination. And we found that in some cases that determination had not been clearly made.
And I can say that often when you have to trim dramatically the budget, the temptation, I can recall working with one particular member whose decision was simply to just shave everything a little bit. The problem is, you might end up with a lot of projects that really it's not a realistic number anymore. I mean, that's the risk of cutting a bill in that way.
And Madam Chair, the other thing we raised as an issue that you'll see is that we sometimes are buying property, easements, and in fee, and so we are building. We also need to make sure that we've filed the declarations that we're aware at MMB of those real estate declarations. So if there's any use of that land or buildings, sale, that we're aware of that and potentially recapture some of the state investment. And so, again, we have some recommendations. Let me just conclude, Madam Chair, by talking a little bit about what doing this audit work is like for us. It's complicated. It's interesting. It's very interesting. It's very engaging. But again, it's quite time-consuming, partly because of the complexity of the criteria, but also because when we do this kind of audit work, we're dealing with multiple agencies. And as you see, there are many responses to this audit report, and even though we were just dealing with a sample of the entities involved, I feel strongly that we need to keep doing this audit work, again, because you spend so much time making decisions about what projects are going to be bondable and how much money you're going to give to them. So we are going to increasingly try to make room in our schedule to do this kind of work, extend legislative oversight and accountability, and I would invite you, any members of the committee, and certainly you, Madam Chair, and others, to express to us some particular areas of concern as we move forward into future audits that you want us to look at. So, again, Madam Chair, thank you for this opportunity.
And I can say, Mr. Nobles, MMB also gets that pressure. I know that one of the things I hear often from entities around the state is MMB is refusing to release the money. I mean, that's the complaint that from some of the projects around, and then because you've just pointed out all of the scrutiny that MMB has to bring to bear, they too get that pressure from the other side. Representative Detmer has a question.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and Mr. Nobles, you mentioned the complexity of the compliance criteria. There's six of them there. Do they all support each other? Are they all in the same language? Or could that cause some confusion with agencies?
Madam Chair, Representative Detmer, you hit on a very important point. It's not only that they are complex, but sometimes they are seemingly in conflict, and you have to make a resolution. And obviously there's a hierarchy. We may have, for example, a guidance from MMB that others might think are not in compliance with either the statutory provisions, the appropriations law, or even the Constitution. So those things need to be worked out, and that is why MMB, as you know, relies very heavily on bond counsel, because these are complex criteria and because they do ultimately have to be supported by the constitutional provisions. MMB often seeks bond counsel opinions on whether or not something is bondable in advance and after the fact. I mean, one of the things that we went through in this audit is where we found complexity and uncertainty. We raised those issues with MMB. What do you think? We don't think this is an appropriate use of bond money. What do you think? And then typically they would consult with bond counsel. One of my concerns, and I know you want to hear from them, one of my concerns was that sometimes the audit, bond counsel opinion you get depends on how you frame and present the facts. And we have at our disposal, as a result of doing the audit work, a lot of detailed facts. But we don't ourselves present those to bond counsel. Bond counsel is hired by the Attorney General, is accessible and available for these questions to MMB and the executive branch. We do not have bond counsel, so we are dependent upon MMB to present the facts as we have found them to bond counsel to make that judgment and determination, and we are not in those meetings. They are considered privileged.
Thank you. Thank you.
Representative Ward. Representative Ward,
thank you, Mr. Nobles. You know, I'm looking at your list is list on page 5 that of the 28 projects that you evaluated. It's interesting. As Chair Hausman, thank you, Madam Chair, was called on me. I was trying to read some of the criteria or some of the verbiage that you had prior to that list, because my question is, what kind of criteria did he use to make the selection of that 28 of those 28 projects? I'm interested in that. It's an interesting list. And before I get to my next question, I want to hear what your answer is.
I did sort of wonder about that myself, Mr. Nobles.
Madam Chair, it is a very important part of us establishing the scope of the audit. And we do have on page 4, I think Representative Ward is referring to page 4, mm-hmm. where we talk about how we came to the sample, of entities and expenditures that we looked at. I'm going to call on Ms. Ferkel to speak about that in a little more detail.
Ms. Ferkel.
Madam Chair, we looked overall at all of the appropriations, and we also did some analysis of all the expenditures that related to the two bonding bills that we examined. But we did need to make some selections to get down to specifics in a project. We can't look at everything. So knowing that if we just took a random sample, we'd be going all over the state and maybe having one project in a variety of places, and it simply would be too big of a scope for us to manage. So we first made a decision about which entities we were going to go to, and we based that on both wanting to select some larger entities and some smaller entities. So, of course, we included Minsku that has a lot of bonding money appropriated to them, and then we also selected some small organizations that maybe just had one project or maybe doesn't often have projects. We did want to have a variety in that way. And then once we get into those choices, we needed to narrow it down even farther for some of the organizations. We couldn't look at everything Minsku had, and we didn't want to take a cross-cutting sample of bond expenditures and end up in 40 different projects. We wanted to be able to focus some of our attention on what was this project about, so we narrowed it down from the broader group of projects at Minsku down to a smaller sample of specific projects, and then chose a sample of expenditures to specifically review within those projects we selected.
Representative Ward.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you for the explanation, and it does lead to my second question. I wasn't going to ask it if I had the right answer, but I didn't hear the right answer. So, our chair and worked so hard to make a bonding bill that is of statewide significance. Period. You know, so I want to know if is there any kind of indicator or any kind of criteria or information that says, you know, that shows a statewide evaluation. So northeast, southeast, central, metro, the whole state. Can you give any kind of comparisons geographically in your evaluation of bonding dollars?
Mr. Noble.
Madam Chair, Representative Ward, we could do that. We didn't do that on this project. It really wasn't within the scope. We were really looking at, did the entities that received the money spend it in compliance with all the various criteria that I just mentioned? Your question, I think, relates to a higher level policy choice that you make in this committee and that the legislature makes. We certainly could do that. I actually have thought at times about whether or not there is a broader evaluation for the Office of the Legislative Auditor to do in the arena of capital budgeting, and that might be something that we could propose. As you know, the list is still open for the consideration in this round of evaluations. Representative Ward, I think I'll put it on the list for you.
And the phrase
please do.
In the paragraph he referenced, there's also the phrase to address the risk of unspent appropriations not being returned to the bond fund. As agencies know, we've tried so hard, because once you bond, you have to fight so hard for that bonding authority that you want it all spent in the way you hoped. And so when there is money that's left unspent for approaching that 4 years when it's automatically canceled, we get sometimes impatient because we're wondering, is that ever going to happen, or should it be returned to the bond fund? And we've pushed that again this year. Representative Dean had one of those moments when he tried to decrease that automatic cancellation from 4 years to 2 years, and discovered there were a few members around the table that got a little nervous because there were reasons why it hadn't been spent, but I think that phrase
all
is
of them good.
That's right.
thank you, Madam Chair.
Representative Earhart.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm thinking it might be easier to discover a wrong spending after the project is done and through an audit, but I don't think we do that. And if we do find something was spent wrong, how do we recover it or penalize or whatever? And when we do on the downside or on the front side, when we give the money to a project, who monitors that all the way down to the nuts and bolts? How do we do that?
And Mr. Nobles, I don't know if you, I mean, MMB will respond to some of that too, I'm suspecting, but.
Madam Chair, Representative Earhart, good questions, and I will leave the monitoring to the MMB because I know they're eager to get up here. But in terms of how do we reconcile the misuse of bond money? And we do have some findings related to the misuse of bond money. And the reconciliation of that would be that the agency working with MMB needs to make a transfer from other funds, needs to make the bond fund whole from other money. This is not uncommon in state government because obviously there are many dedicated funds. And in our audit work, we will, for example, sometimes find that legacy money or game and fish money in dedicated funds was not used for the dedicated purpose in the law. And so when we make those findings, the agencies have to determine what general fund money is typically the resolution. So that's what will happen in response to our findings.
Representative Carlson.
Yeah, I've got a question, but I just was going to comment with Representative Ward's question about statewide. Sometimes that can be an interesting interpretation. Back when we did bonding through appropriations, I'm turning the clock way back before we had capital investment, which we've had for many, many years now. The number one priority for greater Minnesota legislators, especially the farm community, was the Borlaug building on the St. Paul campus. Mm-hmm. Now, one way you can measure that is that that building was physically built in St. Paul on the St. Paul campus, but it was the number one priority, I would say, for many in greater Minnesota. So sometimes how you do the tabulation on some of that can be kind of interesting. But I was going to ask, did you look at questions and how it should be handled when a the scope of a project changes? And I'll give you a couple of examples, turning the clock back. The music building on the University of Minnesota campus, we provided the bonding to build the basically what I'll call the classroom building, but they said they could, for the auditorium, raise the money privately. They were doing that at the same time the Ordway was being built in St. Paul. So they came to me as chair of the Education Division of Appropriations and said, you know, we got a good enough bid on the building where we can do the auditorium. But it was not described in the legislation. And so I said, well, you have to come back. We have to change the law. And there was a bit of a tug of war at the time with the university on that question because one way they looked at it was that they were within the overall cost, but that hadn't been described. Another example of that was virtually a very similar situation back when we had the Waseca campus, U of M, and we had authorized a project, and they showed their working papers had included a greenhouse, but it was never mentioned in the bonding bill. And so again, I said, well, you have to come back to get that authorization to build the greenhouse. And so sometimes you end up in those gray areas. I'm just curious if you looked at any questions like that. I know we talked a lot about computers and things with a shorter life expectancy, but sometimes when a project is underway, situations change, is my point. And I don't know if you have a response to that or not, Mr. Nobles.
Madam Chair, Representative Carlson, again, an excellent point, and I would strongly support what how you reacted, and that is if you're going to make a change in the project, come back and change the law, because we want to see what is in the law in making a determination as to whether or not the money was spent appropriately, not by some adjustment that was informally agreed to later. So yes, those situations come up, and they're difficult for us if we read the law and we don't see that a greenhouse or all the other factors that you mentioned were not authorized, and it's a significantly different project than the one we see mentioned in the law. We have to go by the law, not some informal understanding or agreement that might or might not have been reached. So, I applaud your response because it is very helpful to us as auditors to see that, yes, they came back and they changed the project. They went through the whole legislative process, and you put your stamp of approval on it, because that's what matters to us.
Representative Albright, and then we're going to bring the department up.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Nobles, my question goes to a couple of citations in the report, the first of which is on page 5, where you make mention under citation number 3 with regard to employment and economic development. I'm just wondering if you can elaborate in terms of, I understand the nature, capital nature of these purchases being integral to a building. I note that on page 16 you also reference the purchase of technology for some higher ed facilities that DEED put in place. I'm just wondering if there's a measuring stick or a definition that this committee or any others can hang their hat from, but even more to the point, and you, I think, elaborate on the complexity in terms of working interagency. I'm just wondering if we are not measuring our fiduciary responsibility in the broadest scope possible, or what measuring stick from your perspective is most applicable as we consider these projects?
Madam Chair, Representative Albright, I think, as we did, you have to start with the Constitution, and there's case law around that. The courts have made determinations on what is in bounds for GO bond money and what's out. But then there are bond council opinions. There are, back some ways, AG opinions. But ultimately, I think you make the policy judgment as to whether or not something is deserving constitutionally and in terms of policy. So I think it's the law, and some of it is amenable to amendment by you. Obviously, the session laws are, the statutory laws are, but there is the Constitution. And, we run across this also with legacy money, and many of you have to deal with that as well. Constitutional provisions put restrictions on you as the legislature. So I think a lot of it goes back, in terms of the measuring stick, to the Constitution. It says what it says, but there's much more complexity to it than that. Obviously, you can read that article, but you also need to read the bond council opinions, the case law, and you have staff, both here for this committee, but also at MMB, I think, that can help you with that.
And Representative Albright, I can say that our in-house expert that we consult all the time about every word, Deb Dyson, is the person we turn to, and I'm going to give her one opportunity before you leave just to see if she has any clarifying nothing, because one of the reasons I don't ever like to be rushed on the bonding bill is every word makes a difference. On the Minnesota Valley Regional Rail issue in southern Minnesota, because we didn't say a bridge, when the railroad came to a bridge, they couldn't do it. So in this bill this year, we have to say that. Every word has to be, that we have to get it right. And so literally, when she drafts the accompanying paragraph to a dollar amount, we work very, very hard to get that right so it meets the test. One can occasionally overlook something. So no clarifying questions for you.
Madam Chair, I was just going to say that was the point I was trying to make. You had a more current example than I did. Mine was ancient. Mm-hmm. But, you have to be very careful that those descriptions are accurate. I mean, there's no question about it.
Well, members, we'll invite Kristen Hansen is ill today, and so we're inviting, as she was the assistant commissioner, Corinne Zewers. And I can tell you, members, she is. Oh, and we have the commissioner here. I can tell you that Ms. Zewers is new to the department, and we just know she is going to bring the same kind of very careful oversight to the future work of the department as she gave to us when she was our fiscal analyst, and so we look forward to that working relationship. And Jen Hassemer is also here. So who's kicking us off?
Welcome.
Thank you, Mrs.
Commissioner Showalter.
Madam Chair, Jim Showalter, Commissioner of MMB, and I just appreciate a chance to be here. I'm here with Ms. Hasmer and Ms. Zewers to respond and give you just a little bit of more information from MMB. So.
And I can tell you and members how much we depend on you, because one of the first questions that our committee administrator always asks somebody when they come to us is, have you gone through the MMB process? Because we know, in fact, that is the first screen, and it's not very helpful when someone comes to us cold who hasn't been through that, because we know the scrutiny to which they'll be subjected.
We appreciate that, Madam
Representative
Chair.
Dean, before they start, or?
No.
Oh, after? Okay.
Because, to Madam Chair, to your point, it is a process, and that the work that we do on the front end is really critical to our ability to implement the laws as appropriated. For capital projects, because as the OLA suggested, these are complex projects that have a lot of nuances, very different facts, and that has an important set of implications on how we fund, how we're able to fund these projects. I would like to start just by thanking the OLA. This is a report that has been started a couple of years ago, and 2008 was, I think, the first time in my memory that we looked at the capital projects, and it's an important view to making sure that people far away from this room understand it's not cash, that there are very specific requirements that are related to these appropriations for capital projects, and the OLA staff and team have done a great job of working through that and helping us all, I think, improve our game. We will walk through the letter just in 1 second. I just want to remind the committee, however, that there's one other set of constraints and issues that we try to balance, which is the IRS. That from the federal side, there are also bond requirements and federal tax requirements that are also a critical set of issues that we try to manage in conjunction with the constitutionality and legal issues that are brought up here today. So with that being said, one of the organizational responses we have made to this audit is to put more emphasis on that process that, Madam Chair, you put forward, so that we have very specific sort of responsibilities. We split our capital budget responsibilities. So on the front end, Corinne will be working with the legislature to try and make sure that we have as much information about proposed projects as possible, so that we can vet and highlight bondability issues and implementation issues before they even get to you, and certainly that they're in front of you as you're putting together a bill. And that Jennifer's here to work on the back end, so that the implementation and the post-issuance compliance is there as well. We're also going to be beefing up staff to make sure that we continue to look at and work through audits of grants, capital grants that are going forward. So, you know, I think that's a very useful thing in terms of our capacity and making sure we can meet some of the recommendations of the OLA. Furthermore, we are setting up meetings with the agencies highlighted in this report to discuss those findings. That being said, I'm going to turn it over to Jennifer to walk through some of the specific findings.
Ms. Hasmer, welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My name is Jennifer Hasmer. I'm the Capital Bonding Coordinator at Minnesota Management and Budget. I will just briefly walk through the responses that we have undertaken at MMB to each of the findings in the audit report before you, and then we can open it up to any questions you might have. Specifically on finding one, we have already started work with agencies to recover any ineligible costs that were paid for with bond proceeds, and we'll continue that work until we are satisfied that it's complete. On finding two, in addition to the guidance that we already have made available to agencies and grantees, we will continue to look for additional opportunities to provide clarification on software and computer purchases. To some of the examples that were brought up in the report, we have already vetted, in conjunction with MNSCU, some of the technology projects that were mentioned there, and we found that all of those expenditures did qualify as bond eligible, and we did not find any problems in that regard. We will look at the other expenditures that were mentioned as well. On finding three, we will make the process consistent internally.
Remember, she's referencing, they have a detailed letter which you'd find on page 33, and that's what she's talking us through. So.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Yes. On finding three, we will make the process internally consistent in regards to checking match requirements have been met. for both local projects that are in the bonding bill as well as state agency administered grant programs. And these are conversations we have already begun with the state agencies. On finding four, MMB will continue to collect the declarations required for the projects financed with bond proceeds. And we will remind agencies on an annual basis of their requirement to submit grant reports and the required declarations to our office. Findings 5 and 6 were directed more towards the various state agencies, but we do appreciate the findings that the OLA raised, and we will continue to work with the state agencies on any questions that arise in the course of those findings. And finally, on finding 7, MMU's policy is and will remain, and we will continue to remind agencies that bond expenditures cannot be made prior to the date of enactment of the bonding bill. And just on one final note, MMB would like to note that we appreciate all the work that the state agencies are going through as we work through the issues identified in this report, and we appreciate their commitment to making the process work better.
Representative Dean has a question.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I have two questions for Commissioner Showalter. Just looking at the internal controls that you have for general obligation bonds, we've been having a lot of discussions around here about the different types of bonds that we have, general obligation bonds versus appropriation bonds and other bonds. Can you talk a little bit about the differences, not just from the requirement differences between the bonds, but the internal controls that you might have between, let's say, an appropriation bond and a general obligation bond through MMB, and how do you view that?
Mr. Showalter.
Madam Chair, Representative, good question. I will take an answer, and if Ms. Hassmer or Ms. Zewers wants to add in, that'd be great. But I think the internal controls should be the same, regardless of whether they're a general obligation bond or an appropriation bond or some other debt instrument.
Or a revenue bond.
I think the question is that the different types of bonds have different compliance requirements. And so that as you go towards different types of non-GO bonds, that there are fewer constitutional barriers, fewer IRS, sort of more flexibility in use of those funds. And as a result, the internal controls, that making sure that the requirements of the law are still the same, making sure that the grant agreements are there, that's still the same. But you probably have fewer tripwires over the appropriate use, whether it's private use, capital nature of those bond proceeds.
Did you want to add,
Madam Chair? No, I think that was good.
Follow up, Representative.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I think as we're looking at the trends and how we're paying for things around here, that the easier it is to pass something, the more scrutiny that we need to have downstream in terms of oversight over the dollars. So I think that's going to be something that we want to have a closer eye on down the road this year and beyond.
And one of the ways we can deal with that is that guideline, which we've talked about. Maybe we ought to have a lower percentage guideline for appropriation bonds, anything that of that type.
And I think if we're looking at how we're spending money, whether it's an American Express card or a Visa card, it's all debt that we're imposing on our constituents. So I think that's going to be something that I'm at least going to be more interested in down the road. The second question I have for Mr. Showalter, Commissioner Showalter, excuse me, is something that Representative Earhart brought up earlier, which is how we go about tracking and getting some of this money back. What do we do if we have a problem? And we have been talking about what's bondable, what's not bondable, and our first go-to is always Deb Dyson. She's always right and saves the state a lot of money from keeping us from doing dumb things. So most of that gets caught by Deb up front. But occasionally we talk about things of what's bondable and what's not bondable, and believe it or not, we've said, can we bond for a Zamboni and can we bond for a dolphin?
Well, maybe not the second.
Ironically, Zambonis and dolphins cost $100,000 a piece. I found that out in this committee. But when we're looking at this, and we, through the process, you're building buildings and you're getting costs as things come in. They're coding things and they're turning the costs into MMB. You catch things. You say this is not bondable in your line item. You say we can't pay for that. So that's one control. Another control would be that the project is still going on. You catch something, but you already paid for it, but the project isn't completed yet. And then the third case would be you catch something, the project is closed out, we should have caught it, the money's gone, then what do we do? Can you talk about what you do in terms of recovery in case number two and case number three?
Mr. Showalter.
Madam Chair, Representative, in case number two and number three, we would work with the agency to get a refund of the bonding dollars. The last OLA report noted several instances where bonding dollars were spent inappropriately, and we worked with those agencies to return those to the bond proceeds fund, so that wasn't the case. We will continue to work with the agencies that are cited in this report. So that's more the case number three. And case number two, it's just a matter of timing. Whether the project is completed or not, in some respects, is not, I think, as critical. It is that the bond proceeds are spent appropriately and that we have the internal controls necessary to flag that through our own process. And then the worst-case scenario is that it goes all the way through and the OLA comes at some point in later and says, well, we have questions about this or that kind of stuff.
Thank you, Mr. Showalter, and I just want to thank Mr. Nobles for his good work on this and all his reports, and I'm going to be adding appropriation oversight to my list on my yellow sheet before I turn it into Mary Liz by the end of the day, so thank you.
Representative Earhart?
Thank you, Madam Chair. We're always addressing agencies here, but what about Carnegie Library up in wherever, or Detrail in Crosby? Is there an agency involved in those, Madam Chair? I fail to see that everything that we're bonding goes through an agency.
Mr. Showalter?
Yeah, I'll start. But yes, appropriations are for public purposes, and so there is almost, if you look at the appropriation bill, typically there is a public entity, usually a state agency, oftentimes DEED is the repository, but some organization, state agency, is receiving that capital grant. Corinne, if you want to elaborate any further.
Ms. Seawers.
Madam Chair and Representative Earhart, so like Commissioner Showalter said, we do work with the state agencies, and the money is appropriated to a state agency for a grant to the political subdivision. And then both DEED and MMB, or if there is another agency, the other agency would work with that local unit of government to ensure that the matching funds are available and that we're complying with the statute that requires full funding for projects.
And I can tell you, members, that right now there's one entity like that is complaining to me. But as they lay this out, I think MMB is doing their due diligence in not releasing money in this case. Representative Adkins.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So what about a tortoise?
a longer life.
my real question is, do we? I assume we take that into account in terms of the useful life. I mean, if you're not going to use capital funds, and bond for something that has a useful life of 3 or 4 or 5 years. What is the demarcation point? When do we know that something qualifies versus when do we know that it doesn't?
Madam Chair, Representative, it's a very difficult question, as the legislative auditor mentioned earlier, because technology is baked into the usefulness of many of the facilities that we're building these days. And so that's why the facts are very case-specific, and it is something that we basically have a process, which is it's complex, and rather than having multiple voices trying to then have a separate mediation process, we basically work with our bond counsel. And if they say it's beyond reproach, that this use of this bond proceed is beyond reproach and acceptable, then we go with it. Otherwise, we will have concerns. And so it is a very difficult topic. I don't know, trying to lay that out in advice in advance. We're trying, but it's always going to be very fact-specific.
And Representative Adkins, the current example of that is broadband. There's been an Attorney General's finding on that, but I think that is the one, the recent one that comes to mind that raises the useful life question.
But most importantly, we're not ruling out a tortoise.
That's right.
Dolphins maybe no, but tortoise. And actually, that's where I was going, was with respect to the broadband question, because what sort of framework do we need to establish that we could then count on for, is it 10 years, 20 years? But interesting answer.
And members, at the end of your report, you see a response from Deed, from Met Council, from Amateur Sports, from Military Affairs, from MinSCU, from the Minnesota Zoo, from DNR, from Public Facilities Authority, from MnDOT, and from Bowser, I think, and from the University of Minnesota. All of those, they all make specific response to one of the findings, and so depending on how in-depth you want to go, all of those responses are there. But I would certainly, if there are agencies that intended to come forward, we don't want to deny that opportunity if there are people who want to. I see nobody. Thanks so much. This has been a good education for us, and it shows our responsibility for due diligence, I think, and has given Representative Dean an idea for his the next task. Representative Ward, minutes of March
15th. Madam Chair, I read and will move approval of.
Any corrections? All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed? Those minutes are approved.
A lot of support.
Anything else? Meeting is adjourned.